I was late. That's why I wasn't there for you. For it to be almost the first thing out of his mouth, it must have been bugging him. I liked that. I managed something close to a smile. Thanks for telling me. I was so hot. The yard seemed to be swimming in heat, as if I were looking at the world through rippling glass. He touched my back, I think to help me up. He drew his hand away from my shirt. His hand was bloody. He went on all fours, using one hand to raise my shirt. It was so blood-soaked that he had to peel it away from my skin. Jesus and Joseph, what the hell have you done to yourself? It doesn't even hurt anymore. I heard myself saying it from a long way away, then I was sliding over into his arms, his lap. I heard someone call my name, and I finally passed out. I woke up in the hospital. Dr. Cunningham was bending over me. I thought, we have to stop meeting like this, but I didn't even try to say it out loud. You've lost blood and had your stitches redone. Do you think you can stay in here long enough for me to actually release you this time? I think I smiled. Yes, doctor. Just in case you got any funny ideas about leaving, I've doped you up with enough painkillers to make you feel really good. So sleep, and I'll see you in the morning. My eyes fluttered shut once, then opened. Edward was there. He bent over me and whispered,
"Crawling through bushes on your belly, threatening to cut off a man's balls. Such a hard ass."
My voice came faintly even to me.
"Had to save your ass."
He bent over me and kissed me on my forehead.
Or maybe I dreamed that part.
Chapter 49.
Sometime during the second day in the hospital, they lowered the meds, and I started having the dreams. I was wandering in a maze made up of high green hedges. I was wearing a long, heavy dress made of white silk. There were heavy things under it, weighting it down. I could feel the tightness of a corset under the dress, and I knew it wasn't my dream. I would never dream of clothing that I had never worn. I stopped running through the green maze, looked up into a flawless blue sky and shouted, "Jean-Claude!" His voice came rich, seductive. He could do things with his voice that most men couldn't do with their hands.
"Where are you, ma petite? Where are you?"
"You promised to stay out of my dreams."
"We felt you dying. We felt the marks open. We worried."
I knew who we was. "Richard isn't invading my dreams, just you."
"I have come to warn you. If you had picked up a phone to call us, this would not be necessary."
I turned and there was a mirror in the middle of the grass in the hedges. It was a full-length mirror with a gilt-edged frame. Very antique. Very Louis XIV. My reflection was startling. It wasn't just the clothes. My hair was in some kind of complicated mound, with thick curls hanging down here and there. There was also more of it, and I knew at least some of it was a wig or at least hair pieces. There was even one of those beauty marks on my cheek. I expected to look ridiculous, but I didn't. I looked delicate, like a china doll, but it wasn't ridiculous. My reflection wavered, then grew taller, and it was Jean-Claude in the mirror, and my reflection had vanished. He was tall, slender, dressed head to foot in white satin, in a suit that matched my dress. Gold brocade glittered down his sleeves, the seams of the pants. White boots rode over his knees, tied with huge white and gold ribbons. It was a foppish outfit. Sissy, to use a modern word. But he didn't look foppish. He looked elegant and at ease, like a man who'd pulled off his tie and slipped into something more comfortable. His hair fell in long black banana curls. Only the delicate masculinity of his face and his midnight blue eyes looked normal, familiar. I shook my head, and the weight of the hair made it awkward. I am so out of here, and I started to reach out to shred the dream.
"Wait, please, ma petite. Truly, I have a warning for you."
He looked up as if seeing the mirror as a sort of prison.
"This is to let you know that I will not touch you. I come only to talk."
"Then talk."
"Was it the master of Albuquerque who harmed you?"
It seemed an odd question. "No, it's Papalotl didn't hurt me." He winced at her name.
"Do not use her name aloud within this dream."
"Okay, but she didn't hurt me."
"But you have seen her?"
he asked.
"Yes."
He looked puzzled, and he lifted a white hat and slapped it against his leg like it was a habitual gesture, though I'd never seen him do it before. But then, I'd only seen him in clothes like this once before, and we'd been fighting for our lives, so there really hadn't been time to notice the small stuff.
Albuquerque is taboo. The High Council has declared the city off-limits to all vampires and their minions.
Why?
Because the master of the city has slain every vampire or minion that has entered her city in the last 50 years.
I stared at him. You're joking.
No, ma petite. I do not joke.
He looked worried. No, scared. She didn't try anything hostile, Jean-Claude, honest.
Then there was a reason for it. Were the police with you?
No. He shook his head, slapping the hat against his leg again.
Then she wants something from you.
What could she want from me?
I do not know.
He slapped the hat against his leg again and stared out at me through the glass wall. Has she really killed any vampire that just happened to be passing through?
Oui.
Why hasn't the council sent someone to kick her ass? He looked down, then up, and the fear was in his eyes again.
The council fears her, I believe.
Having met 3 of the council members personally, that raised my eyebrows as far as they would go. Why? I mean, I know she's powerful, but she's not that powerful.
I do not know, ma petite, but I do know they decreed her territory taboo rather than fight with her.
That was just plain scary. It would have been nice to know that before I got here.
I know you value your privacy, ma petite. I have not contacted you in all these long months. I have respected your decision, but it is not merely our romance or lack of it that is important between us. You are my human servant, whether you will or no. It means that you cannot simply enter another vampire's territory without some diplomacy.
I'm here on police business. I thought I could enter anyone's territory as long as it was police business. I'm here as Anita Blake, preternatural expert, not as your human servant.
Normally, that is true, but the master whose lands you are in does not obey council decrees. She is a law unto herself.
What does that mean for me here and now?
Perhaps she fears human law. Perhaps she will not arm you for fear of the humans destroying her. Your authorities can be very effective at times. Or she simply wants something from you.
You've met her. What do you think? He said. It came to my lips before I thought about it.
Power.
She's attracted to power.
You are a necromancer.
I shook my head, and again the hair pieces made it awkward. I closed my eyes in the dream, and when I opened them, my hair just hung around my shoulders like normal. The hair was heavy.
It could be,
he said.
I am happy that you left the dress. I cannot tell you how long I have wished to see you in something like it.
Don't push it, Jean-Claude.
My apologies.
And he did a sweeping bow, using the hat in the gesture so that it swept across his chest. I think it's more than the necromancy. She figured out that I was part of a triumvirate the first moment she met me. I felt her sift through the 3 of us, like unwinding a string. She knew. I think that's what she wants. She wants to figure out how it works.
Could she repeat it? He asked.
She's got a human servant, and jaguars are her animal to call. Theoretically, I guess she could. Though, can you make it a 3-way when you've already got marks on a human and no animal?
If the marks are recent, perhaps.
No, not recent. They've been a couple a long time.
Then no. Her human's marks will be too entrenched to stretch for a 3rd.
So she may be interested in me for a power she can't have? If she finds out then, I can't be of help to her? I said.
It would perhaps be best if she did not learn that, ma petite.
You think she'd kill me?
She has killed all that crossed her path for 50 years. I do not see why she should change her ways now.
I was standing very close to the mirror now. Close enough that I could see the gold buttons on his jacket and the rise and fall of his chest as he drew breath. This was the closest I'd been to him in months. It was just a dream, but we both knew it wasn't just a dream. He'd put the mirror barrier between us because once we'd used our dreams to enter each other's fantasies. He'd come like a demon lover in my dreams, in my sleep. We'd done the real thing, too, but the dreams had been sweet, sometimes a prelude to the real thing, sometimes an end in themselves. The glass grew thinner, as if the glass were wearing away. It was like a thin pane of spun sugar. He touched fingertips to it, and the glass moved like clear plastic, giving at his touch. My fingertips touched his, and the thin barrier vanished. Our fingers touched, and it was startling, electric. His finger slid over mine, and twining, our palms touching, and even that one chaste touch sent my breath racing. I stepped back but didn't let go of his hand, so the movement drew him out of the mirror. He stepped out of the golden frame and was suddenly standing in front of me, our hands still raised in front of us. I could feel his heart beating through his palm, feel the rise and pulse of his body through my hand as if all of him were contained in that one pale hand where it lay pressed against mine. He leaned down towards me as if to kiss me, and I started to pull away, afraid, but the dream shattered, and I was suddenly awake, staring up at the hospital ceiling. A nurse was in the room, checking my vitals. She'd woken me. I wasn't sure whether I was glad or sad. The marks had been open for less than a week, and Jean-Claude was already pushing me. Okay, I needed the warning, but... oh, hell. My teacher, Marianne, had told me that I couldn't just ignore the boys, that would be dangerous. I thought she meant ignoring the power that bound us, but maybe she meant more than that. I was Jean-Claude's human servant, and that made things complicated when I traveled. Each vampire's territory was like a foreign country. Sometimes you had diplomatic treaties between them, sometimes you didn't. Occasionally you just had a couple of master vamps that were enemies, pure and simple, so if you belonged to one, you stayed the hell out of the other one's lands. By refusing to contact Jean-Claude, I could screw up, get myself killed or held hostage. But I'd thought I was safe as long as I was on police business or animating zombies. That was work. It had nothing to do with Jean-Claude and vampire politics. But I could always be wrong. Like now. Why, you may ask, did I believe Jean-Claude and his warning? Because it gained him nothing to lie about it. I'd also felt his fear. One of the things about the marks, you could usually tell what the other person was feeling. Sometimes that bugged me. Sometimes it was helpful. The nurse shoved a thermometer with a little plastic sheath on it under my tongue. She took my pulse while we waited for the thermometer to beep. What really bugged me about the dream was how attracted to him I was. When I had the marks closed off, I'd have never touched him in the dream. Of course, I hadn't let him enter my dreams when I had the marks blocked off. With the barriers up, I'd policed my dreams, kept him and Richard out. I could still keep them out, but it took more work to do it. I was out of practice. I was going to have to get back into practice, fast. The thermometer beeped. The nurse read the little monitor on her belt, gave me an empty smile that could have meant anything, and made a note. I hear you're getting out of here today. I looked up at her. I am? Great. Dr. Cunningham will be in to see you before you leave. She smiled again. He seems to want to oversee your release personally. I'm one of his favorite patients, I said. The nurse's smile slipped just a touch. I think she knew exactly what Dr. Cunningham thought of me.
He should be in to see you soon.
But I am definitely getting out of here today, I asked.
That's what I hear.
Can I call a friend to come pick me up?
I can call them for you.
If I'm getting out today, can't I have a phone? The good doctor had made sure there was no phone in my room because he didn't want me trying to do work, any work, not even business phone calls. When I'd promised not to use the phone if he'd just give me one, he just looked at me, made some kind of note in his file, and left. I don't think he trusted me.
If the doctor says you can have a phone, I'll bring you one, but just in case, give me the number and I'll contact your friend.
I gave her Edward's number. She wrote it down, smiled, and left. There was a knock on the door. I expected Dr. Cunningham, but it was Detective Ramirez. His shirt today was a pale tan. The half-mast tie was deep brown with a small white and yellow design on it. But he'd also kept on a brown suit jacket that matched his pants. It was the first time I'd seen him with an entire suit on at once. I wondered if the sleeves were rolled up underneath the jacket sleeves. He had a bouquet of shiny Mylar balloons with cartoon characters on them. The balloons said things like, "Get well soon," and "Oh, bother." That was the Winnie the Pooh balloon. I had to smile.
You already sent flowers.
There was a small but nice arrangement running long to daisies and miniature carnations on the bedside table. I wanted to bring something in person. I'm sorry I wasn't here sooner. My smile wilted around the edges. This level of apology is usually reserved for boyfriends or lovers, Detective. Why are you feeling so guilty? I have to keep reminding you to call me Hernando. I keep forgetting. No, you don't. You keep trying to distance yourself. I just looked at him. It was probably true.
Maybe.
If I was your lover, I'd have followed you to the hospital and been by your side every minute, he said. Even with a murder investigation going on? I asked. He had the grace to shrug and look sheepish. I'd have tried to be here every minute. What's been happening while I've been in here? My doctor has made sure I haven't found out anything. Ramirez put the balloons beside the flowers. The balloons had one of those little weights on them to keep them from drifting away. The last time I tried to see you, your doctor made me promise not to talk about the case. I didn't know you were here before. You were pretty out of it. Was I awake? He shook his head. Great. I wondered how many other people had paraded through here while I was passed out cold. I'm getting out today, so I think it's safe to talk about the case. He looked at me, and the expression was enough. He didn't believe me. Doesn't anyone trust me? You're like most of the cops I know. You never really get off work. I raised my hand in the Boy Scout salute. Honest, the nurse told me I'm being released today. He smiled. I saw your back, remember? Even if you're being let out, you won't be going back on the case, not in person anyway. What, I'm going to look at pictures and listen to the clues that other people find? He nodded. Something like that. Do I look like Nero Wolfe? I am not a staying-at-home, out-of-the-firing-line kind of girl. He laughed, and it was still a good laugh. A nice, normal laugh. It had none of Jean-Claude's touchable sex appeal, but in some ways I liked it better for its very normalcy. But as nice and warm as Ramirez was, I had the memory of Jean-Claude's dream in my head. I could feel the touch of his hand on mine, a touch that lingered on my skin the way an expensive perfume will linger in a room long after the woman who wears it is gone. Maybe it was love, but whatever it was hard to find a man who could compete with it, no matter how much I wanted to find one. It was as if when he was with me, all other men just faded into the background, except Richard. Was that what it meant to be in love? Was it? I wish I knew. What are you thinking about? Ramirez asked. Nothing. Whatever that nothing is, it makes you look very serious, almost sad. He'd moved very close to the bed, fingers touching the edge of the sheet. His face was gentle, questioning, very open. I realized in a way that Ramirez had my ticket. He knew what punched my buttons, partly just coincidence, partly he read me well. He read what I liked and what I hated in a man better than Jean-Claude had for years. I liked honesty, openness, and a sort of little boy charm. There were other things that led to lust, but for my heart, that was the way. Jean-Claude was almost never open about anything. He always had a dozen different motives for everything he did. Honesty was not his best thing, and his little boy charm, nope. Jean-Claude had gotten there first, and for better or worse, that was the way things were. Maybe a little honesty would work here, too. I'm wondering how different my life would be if I'd met you or someone like you first. First, that implies that you've already met someone. I told you I had two guys back home. You also said you couldn't decide between them. My grandmother always said that the only reason a woman hesitates between two men is that she hasn't met the right one. Your grandmother didn't say that. He nodded. Yes, she did. She was being courted by two men, sort of halfway engaged to both. Then she met my grandfather and she knew why she'd been hesitating. She didn't love either of the two men. I sighed. Don't tell me I've got caught up in some family folklore. You never said you were taken. Tell me I'm wasting my time and I'll stop. I looked up at him, really looked at him, let my eyes follow the smiling line of his face, the shining humor in his eyes. You're wasting your time. I am sorry, but I think you are. Think? I shook my head. Stop it, Hernando. I'm taken, okay? You're not taken until you make a final choice, but that's okay. I'm not the one. If I were, you'd know it. When you meet him, you won't have any doubts. Don't tell me you believe in true love, soulmate kind of stuff. He shrugged, fingers running up and down the edge of the sheet. What can I say? I was raised on stories about love at first sight. My grandmother, both my parents, even my great-grandfather said the same thing. They met that special person and no one existed after that. You're descended from a family of romantics, I said. He nodded happily. My great-grandfather, Poppy, talked about my great-grandmother like they were still school kids right up until he died. It sounds nice, really. But I don't believe in true love, Hernando. I don't believe that there's only one special person for your whole life's happiness. You don't want to believe it, he said. I shook my head. This is about to go from cute to irritating, Hernando. At least you're using my first name. Maybe because I don't see you as a threat anymore. A threat? Just because I like you? Just because I asked you out? He frowned when he said it. It was my turn to shrug. Whatever I mean, Hernando, just cut the juice. It ain't going nowhere. Whatever I decide, it's between the two guys I have waiting for me back home.
It sounds like you weren't sure of that until just now.
I thought about that for a heartbeat or two. You know, I think you're right. I think I've been looking around for someone else, anyone else. But it's no good.
You don't sound happy about that.
Love should make you happy, Anita. I smiled and knew it was wistful. If you think love makes you happy, Hernando, you've either never been in love or never been in love long enough to have to start compromising.
You're not old enough to be this cynical.
It's not cynicism, it's reality. His face was soft and sad.
You've lost your sense of romance.
I never had a sense of romance. Trust me, the guys at home will back me on it.
Then I'm even sorrier.
Don't take this wrong, but hearing you go on about true love and romance makes me sorry for you. You are setting yourself up for the big fall, Hernando.
Not if it works out, he said.
I smiled and shook my head. Isn't it against the rules for homicide detectives to be naive?
You think it's naive? He asked.
I know it is, but it's sweet. I wish you luck finding your Ms. Wright. The door opened and it was Dr. Cunningham. Ramirez asked, Does she really get out today, doctor?
Yes, she does.
Why doesn't anyone believe me? I asked.
They both looked at me. Funny how quickly people caught on to certain aspects of my personality.
I want to do one more check on your back, then you're free to go.
You got a ride out of here? Ramirez asked.
I asked the nurse to call Ted, but I don't know if she did or if he's home.
I'll wait around to give you a ride.
Before I could say anything, he added, What are friends for?
Thanks, and this means you can fill me in on the case on the way out.
You never give up, do you?
Not about a case, I said.
Ramirez walked out shaking his head, giving the doctor and me some privacy. Dr. Cunningham poked and prodded and finally just ran his hands over my back. It was nearly healed.
It's just impressive. I've treated lycanthropes before, Ms. Blake, and you're healing almost that fast.
I flexed my left hand, stretching the skin where the bite marks still showed where the flayed one had bitten me. The bite was pale pink, settling into a nice ordinary scar only weeks ahead of schedule. I wondered if the scar would eventually disappear, or if it would be another permanent one.
I've done a blood workup on you. I even snuck some of your blood down to the genetics department and had them look for something not human.
Genetic work takes weeks or months, I said.
I've got a friend in the department.
Some friend, I said.
He smiled and it was warmer than it should have been.
She is.
So I'm free to go?
You are.
His face got all serious again.
But I'd still like to know what the hell you are.
You wouldn't believe human?
48 hours after your second injury, we had to remove the stitches from your back because the skin was starting to grow over them. No, I won't believe human.
It's too long a story, Doc. If it was something I could teach you to use on other people, I'd tell, but it's not that kind of thing. You might call the healing a bonus for some other less pleasant shit that I put up with.
Unless the other shit is really awful, the healing makes up for it. You'd never have survived the original injuries if you'd been human.
Maybe.
No maybe, he said.
I'm glad to be alive. I'm glad to be nearly healed. I'm glad it didn't take months to recover. What more do you want me to say?
He draped his stethoscope over his shoulders, holding on to the ends, frowning at me.
Nothing. I'll tell Detective Ramirez that he can tell you about the case now, and that you are getting out today.
He glanced at the flowers and the balloons.
You've been here, what, 5 days?
Something like that.
He touched a balloon, making them bounce on their strings.
You work fast.
I don't think it's me that works fast.
He gave the balloons one more whack so they bobbed and weaved like some underwater creature.
Whatever. Enjoy your stay in Albuquerque. Try to stay healthy.
With that, he left, and Ramirez came back in.
Doctor says I can talk about the case with you again.
Yep.
You're not going to like it.
He looked all serious.
What's happened?
There's been another murder, and not only are you not invited to the scene, neither am I.
Chapter 50.
What are you talking about?
Marx is in charge of the case. He has the right to use his resources as he sees fit.
Stop talking political rhetoric and tell me what the little shithead has done now.
He smiled.
Okay. The men assigned to the case are one of those resources. He decided that I was best used at the police property room, going over the items that we've confiscated from the victims' homes, and matching them to the pictures and video we have of some of the houses before the murders.
Pictures and videos for what? I asked.
Insurance purposes. A lot of the houses hit had enough rare and antique pieces that they insured them, and that meant they needed proof that they had the pieces to begin with.
What pieces did you find in the last scene I was at? The one on the ranch?
The smile didn't change, but the eyes did. They went from pleasant to shrewd.
It's not just that you're cute. I like the way you think.
Just tell me.
There were a lot of similar pieces since most of the people had collected things from this area, or the Southwest in general, but nothing out of the ordinary.
Except for this.
He reached behind his back underneath the suit jacket and pulled a manila envelope out that must have been inside his belt underneath the jacket.
I knew you had to be wearing this suit jacket for some reason.
He laughed. He unfolded the envelope and spilled out pictures into my lap. Half of them were semi-professional shots of a small carved piece of turquoise. A glance, and I wanted to say Mayan, Aztec, something like that. I still couldn't tell the difference at a glance. The second set were a few better shots of the object in the study of the man that had been killed. The one that had used salt to interrupt the critter. Then a series of Polaroids, taken from every angle.
You took the Polaroids? I asked.
He nodded. This afternoon, after he decided my best use was not at the murder site. I lifted one of the first series of pictures.
These are sitting on a wooden surface. Much better light. Natural, I think.
Insurance pictures?
He nodded.
Who did it belong to?
The first house you saw.
The Bromwells, I said. He lifted another picture. This one was from the Carsons, and that's it. Either no one else owned one, or they didn't think to get it insured.
Did the people who didn't try to get it insured try to insure their other pieces?
Yes.
Shit, I said. I don't know much about this stuff, but I know that it's valuable. Why wouldn't they try to insure it if they owned one?
What if they thought it was hot?
Illegal?
Why would they think that? I asked.
Maybe because of the two houses we can prove had it, their history of the piece, where they got it and when, isn't real.
What do you mean?
Something like this doesn't just show up. It has to have a history if you want it insured. They gave their papers, what they'd been given, to the insurance company, and just a little investigation showed that the people that were supposed to have unearthed the piece, sold the piece, had never heard of it.
They refused to insure it, I said.
Yes.
There was something in his face, a suppressed excitement like a kid with a secret.
You're holding something back. What is it?
You know what Riker is?
He's a pot hunter, an illegal dealer in artifacts.
Why would he be so interested in you and this case?
I have no idea.
I looked at the pictures in my lap.
You're saying that he sold these to the victims?
Not him personally, but Thad Bromwell, the teenage son. He was with his mother when she purchased it. It was a present for Mr. Bromwell's birthday. They bought it from a shop that is a known associate of Riker. It takes pieces and makes them look legit.
Have you talked to the shop owner?
Unless you've got a Ouija board, we're not going to be talking to him.
He's the newest victim, I said.
Ramirez nodded, smiling.
You got it.
I shook my head. Okay. Riker is unusually interested in the case. He wanted to see me specifically about it. At least two of the victims are people who bought one of his pieces. The shop owner that sold it is dead now, too.
I looked up at him.
Is it enough for a warrant?
We already searched his house. Riker's men are suspected in the killing of two local cops. It wasn't hard to find a judge that would give us a warrant on the crap they pulled out at Ted's house.
What the hell did the warrant give you permission to search for?
They didn't mention stolen artifacts at Ted's house. They just pointed guns at us and said Riker wanted to talk about the case.
The warrant was to search for weapons.
I shook my head.
So even if you found stolen artifacts, you wouldn't be able to use them in court.
It was just an excuse to search the house, Anita. You know how that goes.
Did you find anything?
A few guns. Two without license, but the warrant didn't allow us to knock down walls or destroy things. We couldn't pull up carpet or pull down shelves.
Riker has a secret cache of artifacts, but we didn't find it.
Was Ted with you on the search?
Yes, he was.
He was frowning now.
What's wrong?
Ted wanted to take a sledgehammer to some of the walls. He seemed pretty certain there was a hidden room in the lower areas, but we couldn't find a way to open it.
And the warrant didn't allow you to tear up things, I said.
No.
What did Riker think of all the fun?
He had his lawyer screaming about harassment. Ted got up in his face, not yelling, but in his face, speaking real quiet. The lawyer said he threatened Riker, but Riker wouldn't back it up. He wouldn't say what Ted had said to him.
You think he threatened him?
Oh, yeah. It wasn't like Edward to threaten anyone, especially in front of the police. The case was really getting to him.
So what the hell are these little figures?
No one knows. According to experts, they are Aztec, but very late period, like after the conquest.
Wait a minute. You mean these were carved after the Spanish came and kicked the Aztecs' butts?
Not after, but right about the same time.
Who was your expert?
He mentioned a name I wasn't familiar with at the university.
Does it matter who it was?
I thought you were using Professor Dallas. Marx thinks she's spending too much time with the unholy demons.
If he means obsidian butterfly, then I agree.
Marx and I agreeing on anything. Jeez, that's almost scary.
So you think she's a contaminated source, too?
I think Dallas thinks the sun shines out of Itzpapalotl's butt, so yeah.
Have you shown any of these pictures to Dallas?
He nodded. The ones from the Bromwells.
What did she say?
That it was a fake?
I raised eyebrows at him.
What's the other expert think?
That he understands why someone would think it was a fake, just from pictures. The figure has rubies for eyes, and the Aztecs didn't have access to rubies. So just from pictures, you might assume it was a fake.
I hear a butt coming, I said.
Dr. Martinez got to hold it in his hand, look at it up close, and he thinks it's authentic, something made after the Spaniards arrived.
I didn't think anything was made after the Spaniards arrived. Didn't they destroy everything?
If these are authentic, then apparently not. Dr. Martinez says that he'll need more tests to be 100% sure.
Cautious man.
Most academics are.
I shrugged.
Some were. Some weren't.
So let's say for argument's sake that Riker found these things, and he sold them to some people who knew they were hot, or suspected they were, and sold some to shops that passed them off as legit. Now, something is killing off the customers and following the trail back to Riker.
Is that what he's afraid of?
Sounds reasonable, Ramirez said.
I started looking through the Polaroids. They were back and front shots. Not great pics, but from every angle. It looked like the figure was wearing armor, sort of. Its hands held long, thick strings of things.
What did Martinez say this figure's holding?
He wasn't sure.
There were people curled around its feet, but they were thin and stick-like, not fat and square like the figure itself. The eyes were rubies, the mouth open and full of teeth. There was a long tongue coming out of the mouth, and what looked like blood pouring from the mouth.
Nasty-looking.
Yeah.
He picked up one of the pictures from the sheet, staring at it as he spoke.
Do you think this thing is out there killing people?
I looked at him.
An Aztec god, as in the real deal, out there slaughtering people?
He nodded, still staring at the picture.
If you mean a real god with a capital G, then I'm a monotheist, so no. If you mean some kind of preternatural nasty associated with this particular god, then why not?
He looked up then.
Why not?
I shrugged. You were expecting a definitive yes or no?
I don't know much about Aztec pantheon stuff, except that most of the deities were big and bad and required sacrifice, usually human. They don't have much in their pantheon that isn't a major god. Something big and bad enough that you don't fight it, you just try and stop it with magic or sacrifice, or you die. And whatever this thing is that's been doing the killings, it's not that bad.
I remembered what Nicky Bacco had said, that the voice in his head was still trapped, that what had been doing the killings was just a minion, not the real deal.
You're all serious again.
What did you just think of? Ramirez asked.
I looked up at him and tried to decide how much of a cop he was, and how much of a player he would be. I could never have told Dolph. He'd have used the info for strict cop stuff.
I have information from an informant that I don't want to name right now. But I think you need to know what was said.
His own face was solemn now.
Did you obtain this information legally?
I did nothing illegal to obtain this information.
Not exactly a no, he said.
Do you want it or not?
He took a deep breath and blew it out slow.
Yeah, I want it.
I told him what Nicky had said about the voice and the thing being trapped. I finished with, I don't believe in a real god. But I do believe there are things out there so terrible that once upon a time, they were worshipped as gods.
Are you saying that we haven't seen the worst of it?
If what's doing the killings is just a minion, and the master isn't up and around yet, then yeah.
I'm saying the worst is yet to come. I'd really like to talk to this informant. You would be dandy, but Marks would have this informant up on charges so fast we'd never find out what this person knew. Once you slap an automatic death sentence on someone, they tend not to cooperate. We looked at each other. There's only one person you've talked to that has a rep to get himself an automatic death sentence. That's Nicky Bacco. I didn't even blink. It wasn't like I hadn't known he'd figure it out. I was ready for it, and I'd gotten much better at lying. You have no idea who I've talked to since I arrived. I've talked to at least three people that could be put up on charges with a death sentence attached.
Three?
He made it a question. I nodded.
At least.
Either you are a better liar than I thought you were, or you're telling the truth. I just looked up at him, giving him a blank but earnest face. Even my eyes were quiet and able to meet his gaze, no flinching. There had been a time, not long ago, when I couldn't have pulled it off. But that was then, and I wasn't the same person anymore. All right, if there is some sort of Aztec god out there, what do we do about it? There was only one answer. It's Papalotl should know what this is. We questioned her about the killings. So did I. He looked at me long and hard. You went without police backup, and you didn't share what you found. I didn't find anything about the murders. She told me about what she told you. Nothing. But when I talked to her, she stressed that no deity she knew of would flay people and keep them alive. Later, I figured out that they were dead. She stressed that only through death could the sacrifice be a suitable messenger to the gods. She repeated almost word for word that she didn't know a being or god that would flay people and keep them alive. Maybe we should go back and ask her if she knows of any deity or creature that would flay people and not keep them alive.
Oh, you're inviting the police now.
I'm inviting you, I said. He started picking up the pictures and shoving them back in the envelope. I took the pictures out of the property room, but I signed for them. I brought Dr. Martinez in to see the statue, but it was official. I haven't done anything wrong, yet. Marks is going to be so pissed that you found out important stuff when he meant to just get you out of the way. Ramirez smiled, but it wasn't exactly a pleased smile. I've got better than that. Marks will take credit for the brilliant idea of putting one of his senior detectives on special detail to investigate the relics.
You're kidding me.
He did send me to the property room to look at what we took from the victims' houses. But he did it to humiliate you and get you out of the way. But that's not what he said out loud. Out loud, it's going to make him seem inspired. He's done shit like this before, I take it. Ramirez nodded. He's a very good politician, and when he's not on his right-wing high horse, he's a good detective. Fine. You mentioned that I wasn't allowed on the murder scene either. What gives there? Well, we all thought you were still out of the game, but he got Ted and company excluded by getting the powers that be to agree that Ted hadn't been a big help on the case, and that without you, his newest expert, Ted wasn't necessary on the murder scene.
Oh, I bet Ted's going to love that.
Ramirez nodded.
He was very unprofessional or unlike himself when we searched Riker's place. I've never seen Ted so...
Ramirez shook his head.
I don't know. He just seemed different, close to the edge.
Edward had let a little of his real self peek out where the police could see. He had to be under immense pressure to be screwing up like that, or he thought that it was necessary. Either way, things were bad when Ted started losing focus and Edward's real self came through, accident or on purpose. The door opened, no knock. It was Edward.
Speak of the devil, I said.
His Edward face had been on, and I watched it move like liquid into Ted, smiling but still weary around the eyes.
Detective Ramirez, I didn't know you were here.
They shook hands. I was just filling Anita in on some of the things she's missed.
You tell her about the search at Riker's?
Ramirez nodded. Edward hefted a gym bag.
Clothes.
You didn't have time to drive from your house to here since the nurse called. I packed the bag the night you went in the hospital. I've been riding around with it in my Hummer ever since. We looked at each other, and there was a weight of things unsaid and unsayable in front of company. Maybe it showed, or maybe Ramirez just felt it. I'll leave you two alone. You probably have things to talk about. Mystery informants and things like that. He went for the door. I called after him.
Don't go far, Hernando. When I'm dressed, we'll go see Obsidian Butterfly.
Only if it's official, Anita.
I go in, and we call for uniform backup. It was our turn for solid eye contact and the weight of wills. I blinked first. Fine. We go in with the cops like good little boys and girls. He flashed that warm smile that he could draw from his bag any time he wanted. Or maybe it was real and my cynical nature was showing. Good. I'll wait outside. He hesitated, then walked back and handed the envelope to Edward. He looked at me one more time, then walked out. Edward opened the envelope and looked inside.
What is this?
The link, I think. I explained what Ramirez and I had been discussing, about Riker and why he might be interested in the case on a very personal level.
That would mean that Obsidian Butterfly lied to us, he said.
No, she never lied. She said she knew of no deity or creature that would flay people and keep them alive. They aren't alive. They're dead. Technically, it wasn't a lie. Edward smiled.
That is cutting it very thin.
She's a 900, nearly 1,000-year-old vampire. They tend to cut the truth pretty thin.
I hope you like what I picked out for you to wear.
The way he said it made me start pulling things out of the gym bag. Black jeans, black scoop-neck t-shirt, black jogging socks, black Nikes, a black leather belt, my black suit jacket, the worst for being folded for 2 days, black bra, black satin panties. Jean-Claude had been a bad influence on my clothing. And under it all was the Browning, the Firestar, all the knives, an extra clip for the Browning, 2 boxes of ammo, and a new shoulder rig. It was one of the lightweight nylon ones with the holster itself angled for the front carry downward draw that I favored. I always needed one with a very sharp downward angle to avoid scraping my breast every time I drew the gun. I'd found that the millisecond I lost from the angle was made up for from the second I lost every time I went past my breast and had the flinch reaction. Concealed carry is the art of compromise.
I know you like leather, but most of those would have to be tailored down for you. The straps on the nylon ones can be adjusted down smaller, Edward said.
Thanks, Edward. I was missing my rig. I looked at him, trying to read past the neutral baby blues. Why this much ammo?
Better to not need it and have it, he said.
I frowned at him. Are we going someplace where I'll need this much ammo?
If I thought that, I'd have packed the mini Uzi and the sawed-off shotgun. This is just the normal stuff you carry.
I drew the big blade that would have normally rode down my back. When they cut off the shoulder holster, they cut through the rig for this, too.
Was it a specialty item?
I nodded.
I thought it must be because I asked around, and no one had a sheath for concealment of something that large for the back, especially not when you throw in how damn narrow you are through the shoulders.
It was a custom job. I laid the big knife back in the bag, almost sadly. There's no way to conceal this thing without a rig for it.
Did the best I could.
I smiled at him. No, it's great. I mean it.
Why are we taking the police in with us to Obsidian Butterfly?
I told him what Jean-Claude had told me, though not how the message had gotten through. With the police at our backs, she'll know it's not vampire politics and we'll probably be able to walk out without a fight. He was leaning against the wall, arms crossed. The white shirt didn't quite lay smooth over the front of him. His gun was showing, but only if you knew what you were looking for. A paddle holster, or a clip holster, because the gun was riding outside the pants. It explained why the white shirt wasn't tucked in, and the fact that he was wearing a t-shirt under the shirt probably meant that he had something on him that would chafe without cloth between it and his skin. "You still carrying that band of throwing darts?" I asked.
"You can't see it. Not with the shirt untucked."
He didn't even try to deny it. Why should he? Because you're wearing an undershirt, and because the shirt is untucked. I know, it's partially to hide the gun, but you never wear an undershirt, so you've got to be wearing something under the shirt that would chafe without the undershirt. He smiled, and it was a pleased smile, almost proud, as if I'd done something smart.
I'm carrying 2 more guns, a knife, and a Garrett. Tell me where they are, and I'll give you a prize.
My eyes had gone wide.
A Garrett? Even for you, that's a little psychos are us. Give up?
No. Is there a time limit? He shook his head.
We've got all night.
If I guess wrong, is there a penalty? He shook his head. What's the prize if I figure out where everything is? He smiled that close, secretive smile that said he knew things that I didn't.
It's a surprise prize.
Get out so I can get dressed. He touched the belt where it lay on the bed.
This buckle didn't come black. Who painted it?
I did.
Why?
He knew the answer. So that if I'm out after dark, the buckle doesn't catch the light and give me away. I lifted the tail of his white shirt, exposing the large, ornate silver belt buckle. This is like a freaking Target after dark. He looked down at me, making no move to lower the shirt.
It just clips on over the real buckle.
I let the shirt slide back down. The buckle underneath?
It's blacked, he said.
We smiled at each other. It went all the way to our eyes. We did like each other. We were friends. Sometimes I think I don't want to be you when I grow up, Edward. Sometimes I think it's too late. I'm already there. The smile faded, leaving his eyes the color of winter skies and just as pitiless.
Only you decide how far gone you are, Anita. Only you can decide how far you'll go.
I looked at the weapons and the black clothing like funeral clothes, even down to the things that touched my skin. Maybe it would be a start if I bought something pink.
Pink?
Edward said. Yeah, you know, pink. Like Easter bunny grass.
Like cotton candy, he said. Or almost everything women give each other at baby showers.
When were you at a baby shower? I asked.
Don has taken me to two of them. It's the new thing. Couples baby showers.
I looked at him, eyes wide.
You at a couple's baby shower, Edward. You in something the color of children's candy and baby doll clothes.
He shook his head.
Anita, you are one of the least pink women I've ever met.
When I was a little girl, I'd have given a small body part to have a pink canopy bed, and ballerina wallpaper would have been perfect. He gave me wide, surprised eyes.
You, in a pink canopy bed with ballerina wallpaper.
He shook his head.
Just trying to imagine you in a room like that gives me a headache.
I looked at the things spread on the bed. I was pink once, Edward.
Most of us start off soft, he said. But you can't stay that way. Not and survive. There's got to be some place I won't go. Something I won't do. Some line I won't cross, Edward. Why?
That one word held more curiosity than he usually allowed himself. Because if I don't have any lines, limits, then what kind of person does that make me? I asked. He shook his head, moving the cowboy hat low on his head.
You're having a crisis of conscience.
I nodded. Yeah, I guess I am.
Don't go soft, Anita. Not on my dime. I need you to do what you do best. And what you do best isn't soft or gentle or kind. What you do best is what I do best.
And what is that? What is it that we do best? I asked, and I knew the anger came through in my voice. I was getting angry with Edward.
We do what it takes, whatever it takes, to get the job done.
There's got to be more to life than the ultimate practicality, Edward.
If it makes you feel any better, we have different motives. I do what I do because I love it. It's not just what I do. It's who I am. You do the job to save lives, to keep the damage down.
He looked at me with eyes gone as empty and bottomless as any vampire's.
But you love it too, Anita. You love it, and that bothers you.
Violence is one of my top three responses now, Edward. Maybe my number one.
And it's kept you alive.
At what price? He shook his head, and now the blankness was replaced by anger. He was just suddenly moving forward. I caught his hand going under the shirt, and I was rolling off the bed with the Browning in my hand. I had a round in the chamber and was falling back onto the floor with the gun pointed up, eyes searching for movement.
He was gone.
My heart was thudding so loudly that I could barely hear, and I was straining to hear. A movement. Something. He had to be on the bed. It was the only place he could have gone. From my angle, I couldn't see anything on top of the bed, just the corner of the mattress and the trail of sheet. Knowing Edward, the ammo in the Browning was probably his homemade brew, which meant that it would pierce the bottom of the bed and go up into whatever lay on top of the bed. I felt the last of the air in my body slide outward, and I sighted on the underneath of the bed. The first bullet would either hit him or make him move. Then I'd have a better idea of where he was.
Don't shoot, Anita.
His voice made me move the gun barrel just a touch more right. It would take him mid-body because he was crouched up there, not lying down. I knew that without seeing it.
It was a test, Anita. If I wanted to come against you, I'd warn you first, you know that.
I did know that, but I heard the bed creak.
Don't move, Edward.
I mean it.
You think you can just decide to turn all this off? You can't. The genie is out of the bottle for you, Anita, just like it is for me. You can't unmake yourself. Think of all the effort, all the pain that went into making you who you are. Do you really want to throw all that away?
I was lying flat on my back, gun pointed, two-handed. The floor was cold where the gown had gaped at my back.
No, I said finally. If your heart starts bleeding for all the bad things you do, it won't be the last thing that bleeds.
You really did this to test me.
You son of a bitch. Can I move now?
I took my finger off the trigger and sat up on the floor.
Yeah, you can move.
He eased back off the other side of the bed as I stood up on this one.
Did you see how fast you went for the gun? You knew where it was, you had the safety off and a round chambered, and you were looking for cover and trying to target me.
Again, there was that pride, like a teacher with a favorite student. I looked across at him.
Don't ever do anything like that again, Edward.
A threat? He asked. I shook my head. No threat. Just instinct. I came so close to putting a bullet through the bed and into you.
And while you were doing it, your conscience wasn't bothering you. You weren't thinking, it's Edward, I'm about to shoot my friend.
No, I said. I wasn't thinking anything but how to get the best shot possible before you had time to shoot me. It didn't make me happy to say it. It felt like I'd been mourning dead pieces of myself, and Edward's little demonstration had confirmed the deaths. It made me sad, and a little depressed, and not happy with Edward.
I knew a man once who was as good as you are, Edward said. He started second-guessing himself, worrying about whether he was a bad person. It got him killed. I don't want to see you dead because you hesitated. If I have to bury you, then I want it to be because someone was just that good or that lucky.
I want to be cremated, I said, not buried.
Good little Christian, fallen Catholic, practicing Episcopalian, and you want to be cremated.
I don't want anyone trying to raise me from the dead or stealing body parts for spells. Just burn it all, thanks.
Cremated. I'll remember.
How about you, Edward? Where do you want the body shipped?
It doesn't matter, he said. I'll be dead and I won't care.
No family?
Just Donna and the kids.
They are not your family, Edward.
Maybe they will be.
I put the safety on the Browning. We don't have time to discuss your love life and my moral crisis. Get out so I can get dressed. He had his hand on the door when he turned.
Speaking of love life, Richard Zeman called.
That got my attention.
What do you mean Richard called? He seemed to know that something bad had happened to you. He was worried.
When did he call?
Earlier tonight.
Did he say anything else?
That he'd finally called Ronnie and had her track down Ted Forrester's unlisted number. He seemed to think that you leaving a forwarding number with him would be a good idea.
His face was utterly blank, empty. Only his eyes held a faint hint of amusement. So both the boys had finally grown frustrated at my silence. Richard had turned to my good friend Ronnie, who happened to be a private investigator. Jean-Claude had taken a more direct route. But they'd both finally gotten hold of me on the same night. Would they compare notes? What did you tell Richard? I laid the gun on the bed with the rest.
That you were all right.
Edward was looking around the room.
Dr. Cunningham still not allowing you a phone in here?
Nope, I said. I had managed to untie the back of the gown.
Then how did Jean-Claude contact you?
I stopped in mid-motion. The gown slid off one shoulder and I had to catch it with my hand. It caught me off guard, and I'm never as good a liar on the spur of the moment. I never said it was a phone call.
Then what was it?
I shook my head. Just go, Edward. The night's not getting any younger. He just stood there looking at me. His face had gone all cold and suspicious. I got the bra in one hand and turned my back on him. I let the gown slide to my waist, leaned back against the bed to hold it in place, and slipped the bra on. There was no sound from behind me. I got the panties and slipped them on under the gown. I had the jeans halfway up my legs under the cover of the gown when I heard the door hush open and close. I turned and found the doorway empty. I finished dressing. I had my toiletries in the bathroom already, so I threw them in the gym bag along with the big knife and the boxes of ammo. The new shoulder holster felt odd. I was used to a leather one which fit tight and secure. I guess nylon was secure, but it was almost too comfortable, as if it seemed less substantial than my leather one had.
but it beat the heck out of sticking it down my jeans. The knives went in the wrist sheaths. I checked to see what kind of ammo the Firestar had in it. Edward's homemade stuff. I checked the Browning, and it was his stuff too. The backup cup for the Browning was the Hornady XTP Silver Edge. I changed the clip. We were going into the Obsidian Butterfly as cops, which meant if I had to shoot someone, I'd have to explain it to the authorities later. Which meant I didn't want to go in there with some possibly illegal homemade shit in my gun. Besides, I'd seen what the Hornady Silver Edge could do to a vampire. It was enough. The Firestar went into an Uncle Mike's inner pants holster, though truthfully the jeans were too tight for an inner pants holster. Maybe I wasn't spending enough time in the gym. I had been on the road more than I'd been home. The Kenpo was neat stuff, but it wasn't the same as a full workout with weights and running. Another thing to pay more attention to when I got back to St. Louis. I'd been letting a lot of things slide. I finally transferred the Firestar to the small of my back and hated it, but it dug in something fierce in front. I have a slight sway to my back, so there's always more room for a gun there, but it wasn't a quick place to draw from. Something about a woman's hip structure makes a gun at the small of the back not the best idea. That I kept the gun at the small of my back tells you just how tight the jeans were. Definitely going to have to get back into a regular gym schedule. The first 5 pounds are easy to get rid of. The second 5 are harder, and it gets even harder from there. I'd been chunky in junior high, close to fat, so I knew what I was talking about. So that no teenager out there will get the wrong idea and go all anorexic on me? I was a size 13 in jeans, and that was at 5 foot nothing. See? I really was chunky. I hate women who complain about being fat when they're like a size 5. Anything under size 5 isn't a woman. It's a boy with breasts. I stared at the black jacket. 2 days folded in a gym bag and it desperately needed to go to the dry cleaners. I decided to carry it folded over one arm, on the theory it would unwrinkle a little. I didn't really need to hide the weapons until we got to the club. The knives were illegal if I'd been a cop or a civvy, but I was a vampire executioner, and we got to carry knives. Gerald Mallory, the grandfather of our business, had testified before a Senate subcommittee or something like that at how many times knives had saved his life. Mallory was well-liked in Washington. It was his home base. So the law got changed to let us carry knives, even really big ones. If someone challenged me, all I had to do was whip out my executioner's license and I was legal. Of course, that predicated on them knowing the loophole in the law. Not every cop on the beat is going to know. But my heart is pure because I'm legal. Edward and Ramirez were waiting for me in the hallway. They both smiled, and the smiles were so close to identical it was unnerving. Will the real good guys please stand up? But Edward's smile never faltered as I walked towards them. Ramirez's did. His gaze hesitated on the wrist sheath. The jacket hid the other one. I walked up to them smiling, and my eyes were shiny too. I put a hand around Edward's waist and brushed my arm along the gun I'd thought was there at the small of his back. I've called for backup, Ramirez said. Edward had given me a quick Ted hug and let me go, though he knew I'd found the gun. Great. It's been a long time since I visited a master of the city with the police. How do you usually do it? Ramirez asked. Carefully, I said. Edward turned his head away and coughed. I think he was trying not to laugh, but you can never tell with Edward. Maybe he just had a tickle in his throat. I watched him walk and wondered where in the world he was hiding the third gun. Chapter 51. One of the things I liked about working with the police was that when you went into a business and asked to speak with the manager or owner, no one argued. Ramirez flashed his badge and asked to speak with the owner, it's Papalotl, also known as Obsidian Butterfly. The hostess, the same darkly elegant woman that had shown Edward and me to a table last time, took Ramirez's business card, showed us all to a table, and left us. The only difference was this time we didn't get any menus. The two uniforms stayed at the door but kept us in sight. I'd put the wrinkled jacket on to cover the guns and knives, but I was glad the club was dark, because the jacket had seen better days. Ramirez leaned over and asked, "How long do you think she'll keep us waiting?" Funny how he didn't ask if she would keep us waiting. Not sure, but a while. She's a goddess and you've just ordered her to appear before you. Her ego won't let her be quick. Edward was leaning in on the other side. Half hour, at least. A waitress came. Ramirez and I ordered Cokes. Edward got water. The lights on the stage dimmed, then came up brighter.
We settled back for the show. Caesar had probably healed by now, but not by much. So it would either be a different were-animal or a different show altogether. There was what looked like a stone coffin propped up on the stage, sitting on its end with the carved lid staring out at the audience.